Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, thank you so much, and please continue to help spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring on special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain, while bringing answers and options to making our lives happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, you all can do me a big favor. Please forward one of our shows to your social media group or to someone you know that can benefit from a particular show. And I was just speaking with our guest and saying that we're in a time in which everybody now knows somebody who has dealt with this topic. So I think everybody's going to know someone that they can forward this show to. Now, Answers for the Family will continue to address a variety of issues such as family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. And we'll introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and sometimes fun for you and your family. Now, today, we're going to be talking about cancer and the people who battle it every day. Our guest today, Dr. Stephen A. Curley, is the Oncology Institute Director and Chief of Surgical Oncology at Christus Trinity Mothers Francis Hospital in Tyler, Texas. As professor and chief of surgical oncology and Duncan Comprehensive Cancer Center associate director for clinical affairs at Baylor College of Medicine, he built a world-class multidisciplinary oncology program with significant national and international outreach and stature. He is currently doing the same with Christus Trinity while helping to grow their already impressive clinical trials program. His new book, In My Hands, is a collection of compassionate, insightful, and empowering stories of resilience, hope, and determination, drawn from Dr. Curley's years of patience. These real-life accounts from the front lines of the war against cancer offer important lessons learned from ordinary people about preparedness, courage, perseverance, and acceptance. Dr. Curley, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the show. It's a pleasure to participate.
Well, as I was going into your background, I realized it's probably something that is better shared by you than by me. So tell us a little bit about your background as a cancer surgeon and what you chose to specialize in.
Well, I'll start from the last part there and go backwards. My specialty is cancers of the gastrointestinal system, particularly liver, pancreas, and colon and rectum, although I deal with cancers of all type of the intestine, stomach, small intestine, you name it. And I've been doing this for 28 years now. Finished my fellowship 28 years ago and have been working at taking care of patients with gastrointestinal malignancies all that time. I've also performed research on cancers of the liver and pancreas for the past 28 years because I'm always seeking new and better treatments for patients so we can try to improve their outcomes. And the final thing I'll add, and then I'll be quiet and answer questions, is people always ask you, what led you to become a cancer surgeon? Isn't that tough? And the answer is, yeah, it can be emotionally charged. It can be difficult. Not all of our patients can we help. And sometimes cancer recurs despite what we do. But I developed a strong hatred for cancer when I was a surgical resident. I had the misfortune of having an 18-year-old cousin who developed cancer right as she entered her senior year of high school. And she was treated at the university hospital where I was a resident. And I saw her suffer horribly with her disease over the next year and ultimately succumb. And I saw what that did to her, to my aunt and uncle, to my parents, to everybody who loved her. And it really affected me. So I dedicated my life to battling cancer.
Well, we certainly thank you for that. And as we spoke a little bit about before we went on the air, I come from a generation in which when somebody was diagnosed with cancer, that person, as well as any of us around them, considered it a death sentence. That was what we believed at that time. And although great strides, you know, are being made, I know that the war on cancer, it just rages on. So what are some of the changes you see that have helped us to get to this point where we now, most everyone I know, knows somebody who is a cancer survivor, something that probably 40 years ago we didn't use that term very often.
Well, and you're right. And unfortunately, it was something that struck fear into the hearts of anybody who was given that diagnosis. Still happens, but we are doing better in many diseases. And so the reason for that is we've certainly become better at developing new multidisciplinary approaches. So we know that no one specialty can cure most cancers. So it requires surgeons, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, other caregivers, nutrition experts, you name it. And I'll tell you what has really been, I think, the greatest step was the completion of the Human Genome Project. Mm-hmm. And along with that, the Cancer Genome Project, where we now understand better what the genetic changes are in different types of cancer. That has led to a revolution in the development of what we call targeted therapies or personalized therapies. It has also led to the revolution in immune therapies for some kind of cancers. So we now recognize much better just how diverse cancer is and how even if you take 100 patients with the same diagnosis, say pancreas cancer or colon cancer or breast cancer, it's actually 100 slightly different diseases. And we have to then interact with that cancer and with that individual based on their specific set of circumstances and the genetic alterations they have. And so we have got more agents available to us, more drugs, more treatments, more options, and still a long way to progress and still many more avenues to explore. But that's why we're doing better in many cancers than we were 40 or 50 years ago.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned was immune therapy. If you could talk a little bit more about that, because what I'm envisioning as you're saying that is we're getting better at utilizing our own body to fight it, so to trigger certain things in our own immune system, which I think is incredible. Can you share a little bit more about that? Because I think that's one of the areas that I'm most interested in.
Well, this is something that first came to prominence in the early 1980s. Dr. Steven Rosenberg from the National Cancer Institute started working with a molecule called interleukin-2, which he showed was a normal substance produced by the body. And if you gave that to patients with skin cancer, melanoma, some of them would actually respond and the body's immune system would help kill the cancer. Now, that was a very embryonic stage of immunotherapy. We quickly realized that that particular compound alone wasn't even close to being enough. The immune system is a highly complex system. And the other thing that was found in the last decade was that cancer cells can evade the immune system literally by secreting molecules that block immune function. So one of the greatest strides forward was the development of drugs that we call checkpoint inhibitors, meaning they combat the cancer's ability to block the immune system from recognizing them. So there are only certain cancers that we've been able to, use that type of therapy for, again, skin cancer, some lung cancers, some kidney cancers, some breast cancers. There's a few other cancers where it may help, but the good news is what we found, because of the complexity of the immune system, there is a very long list of new drugs that are currently going through testing that we hope will help with other types of cancer that you didn't just hear me list, including some of the ones that are the most lethal, cancers like liver cancer or pancreatic cancer, some of the brain cancers that are still very, very highly lethal. So the potential exists to develop new treatments in those types of tumors as well, and research is very actively ongoing in those and many other types of cancer.
Well, you sound very optimistic, and I like that. So as you were taking the time to, you know, to obviously do so many great things in regards to healing people, what prompted you to write the book In My Hands, and how did you find time to do it?
Well, it was my patients who encouraged me to write the book. I've always been somebody who kind of keeps track of interesting stories, and I come from a family that had a strong storytelling background. My grandfather, my great-grandfather used to entertain us with stories when we were kids. And I would take notes. When patients would tell me something interesting, I would jot down. I guess today it would be called journaling. I don't know that it was really anything quite that formal, but I would take down notes of interesting things that happened or patients who had interesting tales. And I also learned an important lesson early in my life, and that was to sit down and take time to listen and learn more about patients than just the disease you were treating. And I would tell patients, well, tell me something about what you like to do, or you were in the military. What did you do in the military? What kind of work do you do? And sometimes the most remarkable stories would be told that would really just, you know, you just step back and go, wow, I would have never guessed. And so patients, when they're diagnosed with cancer, obviously that immediately strikes fear into them. And as you noted earlier, frequently it causes them to wonder about their own mortality and their own longevity. So I like to tell patients stories that will give them hope or inspiration, perhaps courage, of people who have succeeded and who have beat cancer. Or, again, as you know, not all of the stories in my book have happy endings. Mm-hmm. Some of the patients do succumb to their cancer. But the way they battled the disease, the courage, the persistence, the humor, whatever they happen to show, whatever I happened to emphasize in that particular chapter was really remarkable to me. And I wanted to really point out that people can have remarkable ability to endure unbelievable stress and struggles. And really, I wanted to celebrate that with this book. And so these are stories I would tell my patients, and they kept telling me, you know, you should write this down. So I took the time. You know, it meant sometimes doing some writing in the middle of the night or on airplanes or on weekends, but I just carved out time here and there and wrote it down over a period of about a year and a half, and there we go.
Well, I'm a firm believer that what we think about, it has such an incredible impact on everything that goes on with our body. So how much is hope a critical component of the treatment or care, where somebody has hope of continuing, or how are you able to bring that into the treatment so that they recognize the value of it?
Well, there's no blood test for a positive attitude, and all of us who are involved in cancer care have certainly seen patients who have beaten the odds, or even if they ultimately die from their cancer, they've certainly survived much longer than the statistics would have predicted. And it's because of that will and that drive that they have. Conversely, I've seen patients who I thought had very treatable disease and had a reasonable chance at surviving who lost hope, who gave up, literally just almost willed themselves to fail. And that's a frightening thing as a cancer clinician to see when a patient just sort of throws in the towel. It's almost like they just sort of say, well, that's it, it's all over. And, you know, that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So it really works both ways, I've learned in my career. People can certainly do much better than we predict and can also do much worse than we would have predicted if they just sort of lose hope.
Now, when I was doing my research, there was a quote that you had to where that you passionately believe that cancer surgeons should treat patients like they're in a family practice. Is that kind of what you're talking about now, where you're working with them and listening to their stories and giving them stories of hope so that helps them throughout their treatment?
Absolutely. And that's one of the interesting things about surgical oncology as a career. You know, for many diseases that surgeons treat, you know, if you have, say, gallstones, you know, you go to a surgeon, you're having pain from your gallstones, he or she removes your gallbladder, sees you once or twice in their office, and then you go about your life and they go about yours. With cancer, I follow my patients for life because we never know if the cancer may recur or if they may develop some complication or side effect related to the treatments they received that we need to intercede and treat. And so I get to know my patients and they get to know me. And so they ask me questions about my family. We talk about their family, their kids, their grandkids, their pets, their vacations. They frequently bring in pictures to show me. It becomes more of a long-term relationship. And they also know from me that I'm going to always shoot very straight with them. You know, one of the hard parts of any cancer clinician's life is the fact that we sometimes have to give bad news to our patients and tell them, you know, look, I'm sorry to tell you this, but your cancer's back, but here's what we can do. Here's our options. This is how we're going to, you know, proceed, or this is what we can recommend to you. And, you know, it really engaged them as a decision maker, not just dictate to them, okay, here's what you've got, here's what we're going to do. Let them know that there are a number of different options and, you know, let them participate actively in choosing which direction they want to go.
Wow. I mean, and that makes really good sense. You know, share with us a little bit because, and we're talking about the, you know, what the patient is going through, but talk a little bit about the highs and lows of just being a cancer surgeon. I mean, to me, the emotional side of that, you know, the wins, the losses, the, you know, especially getting that close to your patients, you know, how often does that, you know, affect you and what do you do to keep yourself at a positive outlook on life?
Well, so it's actually a daily occurrence. You know, I may go to the operating room and do a very technically demanding and difficult operation and, you know, walk out of there just on a adrenaline high because I've just successfully completed a difficult operation. And I know that means I've given my patient a chance to survive. Conversely, I may do an operation that I plan to remove a tumor and get in there and find that the cancer has spread in a fashion that we didn't detect on our preoperative scans, a CT scan or a MRI scan. And that's even though I've warned the patient that that could be something we find, it's still a very painful conversation to have with the family members and then ultimately with the patient, because they know that means that the cancer is more widespread and more aggressive than we had thought. And then, you know, when I see patients in clinic, you know, it's sort of there's highs and lows that can flow through the day. You know, I may see a patient who was told, you know, 10 or 15 years ago they had 6 months to live, and I'm still seeing them based on the operation I performed and the other treatments my colleagues gave them. Conversely, I may see a patient back who I operated on some point in the past, and I open up their scans, and boom, the cancer's back. So I have to go and drop that bad news bomb on them. So it's a series of highs and lows throughout any given day. And the way I personally deal with that is through, you know, fortunately I have people and colleagues and dear friends and my wife who I can talk to and share those, you know, moments with. And it's also through exercise. You know, I used to train soccer teams, when my kids were younger, and I refereed for many years, and I still exercise regularly. I find out that is the healthiest way for me to blow off steam and to work through the angst when I've had a tough week or when I've had bad news that I've had to share with patients. That's a healthy way for me to deal with those sorts of negative emotions and those hard tasks.
And it's interesting that you brought up exercise. And I was just at a seminar this weekend, and we're talking about the value of exercise for people going through certain issues in their life. How important is diet and exercise for your patients? You know, after you've gone in and you've removed what you can remove, and it appears as though things can be going okay, how important is it that, that they continue to exercise, and what do you recommend that they do from a diet standpoint, be it water or food, that might reduce the risk of this cancer coming back?
Well, so nutrition and exercise is critical. All of us involved in cancer care have always kind of known that people who stayed active during treatment, even if they're having, you know, say severe fatigue as a side effect of the operation or from chemotherapy, people who push themselves just seem to do better. And there have been several studies over the past several years that have proven that, where they kind of looked at people's exercise level and realized that people who stayed active, and by active I mean even if that's just walking 30 to 45 minutes a day, actually have a better response to chemotherapy and to radiation therapy. They have fewer complications and side effects after a major cancer operation. And those who maintain good nutrition, that means they don't lose a lot of weight or they don't gain a lot of weight, you know, and eat a healthy diet, once again, that supports immune function, that supports overall health. And those are things that can really help as an adjunct to the treatments we're providing, whether that be a major surgical procedure, during chemotherapy, during immunotherapy. So patients often ask, you know, what can I do to improve my odds? And so that's an easy one to answer. I say exercise, even on days when you're feeling down, when you're feeling bad, when you're feeling really washed out, push yourself, go out for a walk, go to the gym, you know, do something to get your heart rate up. Make sure you're eating a good, healthy diet. Stay away from things that, you know, we all know we should. You know, we all know about the obesity epidemic in this country, the fact that people don't exercise the way we used to when we were kids. They don't go out and, you know, burn those calories. They don't eat healthy foods. And so that leads to other health problems. And so I encourage my patients to avoid those sorts of pitfalls and to stay away from those sorts of foods that we know are not healthy.
Well, it sounds like that would be good advice for anybody if you've been diagnosed with something or not, even from a preventative standpoint. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's interesting. We know right now that, I mean, everybody obviously knows that people who are markedly overweight have higher problems with diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. We now recognize that obesity also increases the risk to develop many types of cancer, breast cancer in women, prostate cancer in men, pancreas cancer, liver cancer. All of these are cancers we're now seeing this starting to see an increase in the incidence of related to obesity. So, yes, it's definitely a way to reduce your risk of those cancers.
So now getting to the book now, as you were writing it, who did you envision your audience would be?
Well, when I started, I kind of thought that it might be helpful to patients or family members when they were diagnosed with cancer or who were still fighting cancer. But then as, you know, I started showing it to colleagues, they pointed out, you know, this is really a good book for cancer caregivers or other people who might be involved in medical care. So I don't want to sound grandiose in any way here, but, you know, I think that as it morphed, the book became something that could be useful for anybody providing care for cancer patients who is a frontline clinician, you know, family practice doctors, internal medicine doctors, people who actually end up making a diagnosis of cancer. And certainly, you know, I've had a number of medical students who've read the book who told me they really found it helpful to realize the importance of that connection with the patient, of maintaining, you know, a certain amount of empathy and compassion, which is not always easy to do when you're tired and you're frazzled and, you know, your workload is heavy. But maintaining that personal connection and taking that chance and maintaining feeling, I think, is an important message.
Well, I'll take it one step further. And I think it's really something that would be good for any of us to read again, because we're now in that time in which everybody knows somebody that, you know, that is a cancer survivor. And, you know, and just to be able to hear stories, if it's something that helps motivate someone to, you know, to continue with their diet regimen or their exercise regimen or something, so that it doesn't come back, or even for those of us just wanting to stay in the best of health. I mean, hearing these stories, I felt anyway, was just, you know, a reminder, you know, and in a very heartwarming way to hear some of the hope and the courage that was expressed. So that would be my thought. Now, what I'd like to ask, but I want to do it, have you answer when we come back from a message, is I want you to talk about the impact of a cancer diagnosis on more than just the patients, because, you know, we have family, friends, coworkers, and so much more. So we're going to take a break, but when we come back, hopefully the doctor will be able to share with us how this impacts more than just the patient. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Founded over 30 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, Westshield has continually focused on resolving issues that negatively impact families and businesses. Our signature therapeutic transportation service helps to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely transported to specialized schools, programs, and treatment centers with unsurpassed experience and success. We are supported by our full-service licensed investigation agency that has legally, professionally, and compassionately located hundreds of runaways and teens. We are experienced and qualified to help, offering solutions which may include referrals to our international network of top professionals in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, psychiatry, and investigations. Simply put, Westshield Adolescent Services and Westshield Investigations are the best solutions when your family is facing a personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 1-800-899-8585, or visit our website at westshield.com. Thank you.
And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family, and we are talking with Stephen A. Curry, a cancer doctor who has written a book that is really taken a lot of stories from patients and put them together in such a way that I think, you know, it shows so much compassion. It shows so much courage. The book is called In My Hands. And when we went to break, the question I asked was if you could talk to us about the impact of cancer diagnosis on the patients, but more so on everyone else that's close to them.
Well, so the impact is profound, and so I'm going to share with you a frightening statistic. It's currently believed by the National Cancer Institute and the American Cancer Society that 38% of Americans will be diagnosed with a cancer at some point during their life. So that's more than a third of us. So that means that there's no way you're not going to know somebody who was diagnosed with cancer if it's not you yourself. So a result of that is that if, you know, a family member, a spouse, a loved one is diagnosed with cancer, a child, a parent, you're going to be affected. And because of that, you know, you're suddenly going about your life and boom. Cancer is diagnosed, and somebody that you work with, somebody you know, a family member. And so it disrupts your whole life because suddenly you have to think about, wow, how is this going to affect our family? How is this going to affect our workplace? How is this going, you know, is this person going to survive this disease? you know, if this is the breadwinner for a family, wow, what are we going to do if you know, they don't survive? Who's going to, you know, bring home a paycheck? Again, I can go on and on and on. It is a total disruptor to the normal stream of the everyday life of everyone around that person. And it can't help but incite fear and uncertainty.
Now, share a little bit about just, you know, a little bit more about the emotional side, but also the things that we go through as humans when we have a loss of productivity, a loss of skills, the fears that come from financial insecurity.
Well, and you know, that is a huge one. And the other component of that is a diagnosis of cancer immediately inserts financial instability into the lives of many people. You know, we may have insurance, but based on the insurance, you know, it pays for only a portion of the care, and the cost of modern day cancer care can be truly incomprehensible. You know, it can easily run into hundreds of thousands of dollars by the time you consider the cost of surgery and chemotherapy drugs. You know, I spoke earlier about the fact that we're in an exciting time where new drugs are being developed. The downside to that is many of these new drugs are prohibitively expensive. And if an individual doesn't have an insurance plan that pays for those, you know, they can be faced with dire decisions. You know, do I take out a second mortgage on my house? Do I dip into my retirement funds? These are all very real decisions that people are forced to make that they really had not planned to make. And I've seen people struggle mightily with, you know, how do I handle this? And what is the effect going to be on my family, regardless of whether I survive it or not? You know, I've seen people who were planning to retire or near retirement who were not able to do that because of the cost of their cancer treatments and the fact that they had to continue working to maintain insurance or to pay the bills. So it is something that I think is not talked about or considered enough, but the financial strain and burden this puts on patients and their families is just really incomprehensible.
Well, we have a listener comment that is coming in that I think touches right to this point. This one reads, "My father passed with cancer several years ago. I do believe that his example in dealing with death was an inspiration for everyone who knew him. Unfortunately, there are so many families that have the opposite situation. I have two friends right now with cancer, and they are very depressed because their treatments are not working. I have been struggling to find a book to lighten their spirits. After reading the summary on Alan's site, I ordered a couple of copies as I believe your book may just be what I've been looking for. Thank you so much for all that you do." And this is from Allison in Virginia.
Well, thank you, Allison, for that very, very kind remark and for taking the time to write that note. And I certainly do hope the book provides some level of comfort or support to people. Again, you know, I've had people who have written to me after reading the book, and they say, you know, we don't really quite know what to make of it. You know, some of the chapters we end up laughing, and then the next chapter we're in tears. And, you know, those highs and lows are a reality of what we deal with. And I know it's sort of funny to hear a cancer surgeon say, well, yeah, that you're going to laugh at some of the chapters. Well, you know, there are some of the chapters that do have humorous stories in them or events that, you know, made me and the people around us laugh. And I think that's an important part of what we do, is providing, you know, some support, you know, honoring and respecting those people who are distressed and depressed at a diagnosis of cancer. And then other people, you know, it's amazing the spirit they show, and they're upbeat and they're positive, and they'll come in and tell you their latest joke, and it's really remarkable to see that. And I respect whatever approach it takes for a person to get through the disease. And so the fact that she has friends who are feeling very depressed, that's a reality. You know, the mental health part of a diagnosis of cancer is something that we must recognize and support, and that we must, you know, ask the patient, how are you dealing with all of this? How are you doing? Are you getting enough sleep? Are you getting the rest you need? Are you eating well? And treat appropriately if they're not.
We have another, this is a question coming in, and this one reads, as a psychotherapist in an area north of San Francisco, California, 6 years ago, our local hospital's oncology department approached me about assisting them with counseling cancer patients. What started as just another area of my work has become my passion, not only working with the cancer patients themselves, but also a group of us have set up service for their family members and their caregivers, the healthcare providers treating these patients. A hospice and end of life does a great job, but the ones in between are truly in need. We're looking forward to listening to your interview. We need more books like this that are not afraid to tackle this very difficult and sensitive topic. And this is from Barry W. in north of San Francisco.
Well, again, a very poignant remark and very much appreciated. And I think something that's underemphasized, and this is something that is being talked about now more in the medical and caregiver field in general, which is burnout. It's a very real phenomenon. You know, we take great risks with our own mental well-being if we don't find healthy ways to deal with the pain and angst of a patient who is suffering. As family members, I've seen, you know, I will sometimes take a family member aside and I said, look, I don't mean to be invasive here, and I know that your loved one is my patient, but I'm going to tell you, I'm worried about you too, because you're here constantly, you don't seem to be eating well, you don't seem to be resting, and I think we can sometimes forget that everyone around the patient is affected. And so something like what Barry's talking about, I think, is a great service. You know, really interacting with everyone involved, the caregivers, the family members, friends, whoever it happens to be, because all of them are affected by that diagnosis.
And I think it's a great point, and I hope that it's going on in many other cities as well, where they're recognizing the connection between, you know, the physical thing that they're going through and the mental state that they're in while they're going through it. Now, I noticed in the book that you showed a wide variety of patients in your stories. You had young, you had old, you had rich, poor, religious, you had non-believers. Was that intentional? And if so, what was your thinking on this?
Well, so cancer is promiscuous. Cancer doesn't care who you are. And so cancer can strike anybody. It doesn't matter how rich or important you are. Doesn't matter your socioeconomic status, your religious status, your sexual preferences, you know, name whatever you want to in terms of a group. So cancer is truly one of the most democratic of diseases. It will hit anybody. And so I think the reason I specifically chose to tell those stories is to point out that many of the topics that are currently dividing us in this country or around the world, in my mind, are somewhat nonsensical. And I don't mean to make a political statement out of this, but it's just, you know, it really points out the fact that cancer can really hit anybody. And so that we need to be mindful of that and be inclusive and not exclusive, and be welcoming rather than divisive. And so that's the approach I take with my patients. I really don't care what background they come from. I don't care if they're rich or poor, don't care the color of their skin, their religious persuasion, could care less. To me, they're a person frightened, battling a potentially lethal disease. I need to be focused on making their life easier, not harder.
Well, that was so well said, and I couldn't agree more. And it was interesting, as you were saying that, the thought came to my mind that cancer exploits, and then eventually its goal is to kill its own host. I think if people think about it that way, then maybe they will also understand that that you can take that same analogy and put it in other things as well. It's certainly not good for you. Now, as those that listen to this show frequently, and I want to make sure that we have time to get this in, they know that I love to hear inspiring stories. Again, having had a chance to read some of them myself, I would love for you to share a couple of the stories that inspired you the most.
Well, I get a lot of comments about the very first chapter in the book, and I guess I can claim that the gentleman that I wrote that story about is probably the one who I learned the greatest amount from early in my career. That chapter is called A Fishing Story, and I was within my first 6 months of being a young faculty member and having just trained many years and now taking care of patients. This gentleman came in to see me. He was a Baptist minister from Mississippi. He was very distressed and depressed because he had been told by his medical oncologist that because he had colon cancer that had metastasized to his liver, he probably had 6 months to live. And this minister's hobby was fishing. So the medical oncologist said, preacher, you should go get in some fishing. Well, this man and his family came to me, and I looked at his scans. I thought, wow, this is going to be a tough one, but I think I can surgically remove these tumors. So I went in and talked to him, and I told him I thought it was possible. And he brightened up right in front of my face and gave me a very eloquent speech about never denying somebody hope, and that, hope was important for any of us to survive this life in this world. So I did a difficult operation on him, and he recovered from it quite well. And the interesting part of the story is, you think being a minister, he would, practice some forgiveness. He had a little bit of a mean streak to him. He was a big, imposing man with a bass voice, and I could only imagine him, preaching from the pulpit, scaring the holy living daylights out of his parishioners. And after the six-month period passed where he had been told he would no longer be walking this earth, we got into a habit and a ritual where he would have me call his medical oncologist in Mississippi, and I'd hand the patient the phone, and he'd get on the phone and say, "Hello, doctor, it's me. You want to go fishing?" And, of course, that was a breach of decorum and professional courtesy on my part, and I'd get on the phone and apologize. And the medical oncologist, God bless him, to his credit, would say, "Thank you for doing this. This is a great lesson." And it actually got to where when I would see the man, the medical oncologist would be looking forward to the call. And he said, "I never tell patients how long I think they're going to live. I tell them, you're not a statistic. We'll do our best for you. We'll hope for the best." And that man lived 11 years after being told that he had a disease that would claim him within 6 months. And he died of a stroke. His cancer never came back. So that was an important lesson to me to, kind of ignore the probabilities and the statistics and always give every patient every chance you can. To be willing to push the envelope, to do difficult things, in my case as a surgeon, sometimes difficult and risky operations. And as a result, I've had some patients who, again, if you read the probabilities of their survival, they weren't great, but they lived for many, many more years than I would have ever predicted. So he's a great example of that, and he taught me, never deny someone hope, never give up, and to continue to be there and be present for patients, even when cancer has recurred and it's clear that they are going to succumb to the disease, to stand with them and support them in whatever way I can as a clinician.
Well, speaking of hope, what are some of the changes you see in the future? So what can we all look forward to and why?
Well, we continue to get better at finding ways to screen and diagnose cancer. I've been involved in a number of research projects where we're trying to look at new blood tests we now realize, for example, that cancer cells can be detected in the blood early. in many tumors. And so I'm participating right now in a project with colon cancer specifically, trying to see if we can find small fragments of DNA from cancer cells or actually circulating tumor cells to make a diagnosis earlier to where we can intervene earlier. We clearly know that the earlier stage we diagnose a cancer at, the better the patient's probability at long-term survival. So there are, you know, many avenues of active research for just about any kind of cancer you can imagine, looking at trying to find ways to diagnose the cancer at earlier stages of disease. So I think that's one thing that we continue to make progress in, and that I'm hopeful will continue to lead to improved diagnosis of earlier stage disease. As I mentioned, I think we also have new treatments coming online that will be more and more patient specific, and will really look at what sort of behaviors or molecules or genetic abnormalities are present in any given individual's cancer, so that we can then give more specific agents that will, in many cases, not necessarily cure the patient. I think we need to get past that idea that anything less than a cure is success. I'll tell you what I tell my patients. I say, you know, if you're diagnosed with diabetes, you will have diabetes the rest of your life. But if you control it, if you eat the right diet, if you take your medication, you keep your blood sugar under control, you can live a long and normal life. So that's the direction we're also going in cancer now, is if we can stop it, if we can control it for long periods of time and do it with drugs that aren't so noxious and awful that it affects the quality of somebody's life, that's a success. So there are many cancers and many drugs that are now being developed that may just sort of stop cancer in its tracks and not necessarily get rid of every trace of it, but just keep it from, you know, its sort of relentless march and continuing to grow and spread and ultimately cost the patient their life.
Now, it sounds like you're also saying that one of the most important things is early diagnosis. Are there things being done? Are there things being done to where we're screening for it more frequently so that we can get early diagnosis?
Well, I think with some of the cancers that are the most insidious and the most lethal, and I'll use pancreatic cancer as an example, you know, we haven't done much to move the needle on survival long-term for pancreas cancer in almost 5 decades. So there's very active research at looking to try and find ways to diagnose that cancer early and to predict people who are at higher risk to develop it. So that's the direction I think we need to be focusing on, is how do we find people who are at risk and how do we make a diagnosis at an early stage where we can do something either surgically or with other novel treatments where we can really eradicate the cancer before it's spread. Because once that particular cancer has spread and metastasized to other organs, the treatments we have are not that great. Now, maybe we'll find some new treatments as well. That would obviously be, a lofty goal. Are we there yet? No. But again, there are people who are very actively working in that field.
I was just looking. I wish that we had more time. For anybody out there, if you want to learn more, you can go to drstephencurley.com. And is that .blog? Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay, so that's Dr. Stephen, that's STEVEN, Curley, CURLEY, .blog. If you want to get more information, go to his blog, go out and pick up the book. Again, I think it's going to be helpful for literally anyone. So, Stephen, I just want to thank you and really acknowledge you for what you've done, not only just from the standpoint of extending these people's lives, but, you know, really putting something out there now that tells other people that they can have hope. And I think that that's going to have a domino effect throughout the future. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. And I appreciate your time. And it's really been an enjoyable experience. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Now, for everybody else out there, as we get ready for next week, if you're someone who is not fulfilled in your job, or if you know someone who's not fulfilled, doing their job or it's not fulfilling their needs. And I don't mean just monetarily. If so, please be sure to put us on your calendar and tune in next Monday when we discuss work that matters, creating a livelihood that reflects your core intention. I can't tell you how important I think it is that, you know, if you have something that you do that you love. I mean, we just had, you know, with Dr. Curley, we just had him on. Okay, he got involved in something and it became a passion. And when it becomes a passion, it's not work anymore. So please listen and listen next week. And when you get a chance, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com or subscribe to our show through iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. And if you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will help us reach more people, and it's greatly appreciated. Next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page, check out some of our latest posts, and if you like them, please like us and share it with others. This way, we can make a positive difference in the lives of others. So for everybody out there, be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza, right here on LA Talk Radio.